Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in once again. It's David Summers, and here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. It's the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring and back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall and treetop tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. And Ron, let's start off by saying congratulations. Your last Studcast set a new record for listeners in the first week after release. It is truly amazing how your audience just steadily grows and grows. With this Studcast, you are only 6 Studcasts away from 7 years of recording your family's wrestling history and so much more, and all 1 full hour or more at a time. That's crazy.
Well, you know, I think I owe it to all the fans, man, to just keep coming. They keep coming back for more. And so I've covered my grandfather's, basically his history. I've covered my father's history. Now I'm into my 10th year of my history in the sport. And I started wrestling full time in June of 1970. And now I'm in the month of July, 1980, and we've still got so much yet to come, man. Southeastern's best years. Then the biggest company of my career, CCW, Continental Championship Wrestling, from 1985 until 1987. And hopefully we'll be able to finish with the USA Wrestling in 1988.
You know what? At your present pace, breaking it down weekly, you are now at least 358 hours into this monumental undertaking with potentially another 500 hours more. You are also covering so many different aspects of the sport, as few are qualified to do, by the way. You speak from a wrestler perspective, booker, promoter, and owner's point of view. You're doing something never done before, to my knowledge, in the sport's history while creating a legacy simultaneously.
Well, I never looked at it that way, I guess, Dave. You know, I'm doing something, man, I really enjoy. And if it brings pleasure to my listeners, what more could I ask for? It's true. I have done it all in my time in the business. And why not pass those experiences on to others?
All right. Speaking of passing along experiences, what kind of experiences are you going to be passing on to us today?
We're going to start in Tennessee with another hidden history lesson about the southeastern Knoxville territory. And this one's going to be very interesting, but sad for fans in that area up there. And we're going to follow that with a tremendous card in the red-hot southeastern Gulf Coast territory. It had 5 main events on it in a 7-match card, with Commissioner Don Curtis returning from his vacation and looking for the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Jerry Stubbs, after what happened in the last TV show. So we're also going to cover the new TV show, the results of the matches in the arena and the attendances in the 3 biggest cities. And then after all that, hopefully we're going to have enough time for a learning tree question.
I love the title for this Studcast. 5 main events in a 7-match card. So I can't wait to hear how that is even possible. It sounds like another history-filled show with a hidden history lesson about the southeastern Knoxville territory. So where does this lesson start, Stud?
Well, we're going to begin this with the new Georgia promoters and their next card in the Knoxville Coliseum. We're going to be talking about Thursday, July 10th, 1980. This was going to be a very sad day for all wrestling fans in that part of the country. It was going to be the last Knoxville Coliseum card for these new promoters. And it's a very bad sign for the future up there at this point. And their crowds have been falling basically from the day they took over from me 9 months earlier in November of 1979. And they were now down to a point that they could no longer afford to even run events in the Coliseum. So the territory, after years of fantastic growth, had now declined in attendance to the 1976 level where it was 5 years earlier. So we're talking about back before I was able to produce crowds large enough to afford to run regularly in the Coliseum. When I first went there, we were in Chilhowee Park. And, we finally were able to move out of Chilhowee Park. But it appears that after this show, the new owners are going to be moving back into Chilhowee Park for the rest of the summer. Now, I've had no idea how hard their wrestlers were working at these Coliseum events. And that's critical right there. To them, you know, knowing wrestlers, it was probably just another night in another city. And I had always conveyed to my crews how critical it was to give everything you had, especially when we had these Coliseum shows and the early ones, because the goal was to try to do good enough to be able to stay there in that building. So their crew was driving from Georgia and wrestling on their longest trip of the week for them, in front of what was probably maybe their smallest crowd of the week. Horrible to say that, but it's probably true. Obviously, their crew up there, from down there in Georgia, they were going to be more concerned about the Omni matches in Atlanta than the Coliseum matches in Knoxville. That was for sure. So it was up to the booker and every territory to make sure that your wrestlers worked just as hard for 1,000 people as they did for 10,000 or more. So I doubt their booker, Ole Anderson, even came on the Knoxville trips because his name had not been on any of the cards that we've been talking about up there.
I think I get the idea here, Stud. The boss wasn't showing up for work. The building was more than half empty, and the wrestlers were not giving it everything they have. All right, speaking of wrestlers, who was on this Knoxville Coliseum card? And take us back to Thursday, July 10th, 1980.
Well, it was the opening. It had a very good wrestler on it, a young wrestler named Terry Taylor. He was going to be wrestling against a former Knoxville star who was a big star a year earlier, in 1979, Alexis Smirnoff. Dennis Condrey, a future Southeastern Gulf Coast Midnight Express fame, was going to be taking on Iron Mike Sharp, who I know very little bit about Iron Mike. This time, it was Austin Idol rather than Tommy Rich going up against Abdullah the Butcher. So Abdullah's back. Instead of Austin Idol, this time he's going to be facing Tommy Rich. This time he was facing Idol. And Tommy Rich was going to be joining Mr. Wrestling, too. This time, he would be joining Wrestling, too, and they're going to face the Assassin. The main event was a $1,000 challenge match. Tony Atlas, great star in that area down there, versus Baron Von Raske. And again, Ole had sent, obviously, his A-team. But I kind of warned Jim Barnett before I'd left Tennessee that he should have at least 6 matches on all these Knoxville Coliseum cards. And again, on this night, he only had 5 matches. So I'm going to put my booker's hat on now, you know, and I'm going to highlight some of the mistakes I think their booker, Ole Anderson, was making. And the first of which was not being there, obviously, as the booker for every card. How can you be a booker in a major city and you don't go there? And there's a perfect example of how booking on this card with Mr. Wrestling 2, Johnny Walker, and the Assassin team, and how they had booked on the 5 Knoxville cards in July of 1980, and what a problem this booking from Ole was. So Ole started with a series of Knoxville matches, basically on July 3rd, 1980. They're going to have 5 matches in the month of July, because it's a lengthy month, And they were going to be wrestling Mr. Wrestling too, and a partner versus the Assassins. So on the first week of that month, Austin Idol was wrestling Two's partner for that very first week, which was July 3rd, 1980. The following week, on July 10th, what we're talking about in this one, Mr. Wrestling 2's partner is not Idol, but this time his partner's Tommy Rich. Then on the third week in July, it wasn't even a tag match between these people anymore, but it was a Mr. Wrestling 2 in a single versus just one Assassin. And there was a mask versus mask match. You know, the loser had to unmask. On the fourth week, it was a single match again. This time it's a lumberjack match between Mr. Wrestling 2 and the same Assassin. And then on the last week of July, it went back to a tag match again. But all of a sudden, now it's a cage match. And Mr. Wrestling 2 doesn't show up with either Tommy Rich or Austin Idol. He has a third partner named Stan Hansen, who was going to be going against the Assassins.
All right, so that didn't make much sense at all to me. Usually, you had the same four guys together in all kinds of matches, but there was a cage match?
Yeah, I mean, it did. It certainly wasn't my style of booking, let's put it that way, you know. I always focus first on working a very strong angle between two wrestlers, or in this case, it's going to be a tag match, goes to a cage, and with four matchers. Wrestlers in the tag match, and I wanted to get a rivalry started, something really good to get people into this program that was going to come. And then you began with a program, and that was booking basically the same four guys against each other in different kinds of matches, and then ultimately that would lead up to a cage match or some other kind of match that's going to end that series. And for it to work, it was critical to have the same guys involved, obviously, every week. So Ole's five-week program started with two tag matches. The first was Austin Idol and Met Wrestling 2 partners versus Assassin. In the second week, it was Tommy Rich as Wrestling 2's partner. Then in the third and fourth week, it was single matches between Wrestling 2 and only one Assassin. And one of those matches was a mask versus match, and the other was a lumberjack match between the two of them. Now, I have no idea why Ole switched the tag to a single match, much less why he had a mask versus mask match between them before having the lumberjack match. Because if you have the lumberjack match, it's kind of a lead up to a bigger match, which is the mask versus match. And then in the final week, here comes Ole, and he books all of a sudden another tag match, this time a cage match of all things. And neither of the two masked men had even unmasked after the mask versus mask match. So I'm confused here, man. And so then it gave Mr. Wrestling 2 a new partner in this tag, in this last cage match, Stan Hansen. Great wrestler, but why Stan? You know, and why not one of the other two guys?
Wait, there was a mask versus mask match, and neither man took their mask off?
That's the way I see it. That's the way he promoted it. Had a mask versus mask match, and then he came back the next week in a lumberjack match. Same guys still got their mask on. What happened there?
None of that made any sense to me. All right, so that was three different partners in 3 weeks leading up to a cage match?
I mean, you know, when things don't make sense, Dave, that's when fans begin to ask themselves questions. Yeah. And many times, soon after that, they lose interest.
Yeah.
You know, like me, I'm saying, what happened here? Why is this book like this? Why do you have a mask versus mask and nobody gets unmasked? I mean, it's very confusing. So that was a lot of reason why crowds were getting smaller and smaller there. I mean, obviously, this is some bad booking in this five-week period. So after all that, they were giving up on the Coliseum, and they were going to move back into the Chilhowee Park Amphitheater because it was summertime. And they were basically giving up on ever being successful. There was so much wrong in this move, man. One more thing in particular, you know, and at least once every summer, and sometimes more than once, outside in the amphitheater in Chilhowee Park, you're going to get rained out. It happened every year we were there and tried to run in the amphitheater out there. You're going to get rained out at least once, and you may get rained out twice during the summer months. So it was bad enough for me back in the day when we got rained out because the wrestlers, all of them in the crew, didn't get a paycheck. But the good thing about it, if there was a good thing about it, is that at least they live there. Now you got these Georgia wrestlers, they all live in the Atlanta area. And when they start up there to wrestle on a Friday night, and actually they change the night to Thursday to make it even worse, but when they start up there to wrestle, they have no idea what the weather is. And when they get there and it's raining, they've made a 400-mile round-trip drive for literally nothing.
Wow.
No money. And then they got to ride back to Atlanta, not even getting paid.
Wow. I had not even considered that. That was probably at least a 6-hour drive for no money at all. And everything they were doing, it just completely sounds wrong. So what was the attendance on this last Knoxville Coliseum show?
Well, on our last guest, which is the week before on July 3rd, that we talked about what was going on in Knoxville. So on July 3rd, which is the day before a holiday, it's not a really bad night because everybody's off the following day. And they had less than 2,000 in attendance on that July 3rd, Thursday night, July 3rd. Now, this is the last show in Coliseum. It's on a Thursday again. They had less than 1,500 people. It was the smallest crowd, Dave, ever for wrestling in the Coliseum. And when you compare that to setting the all-time record, attendance record for a sports event in the Coliseum, just 3 years earlier, wow, it just kind of highlights how far wrestling had gone down and how bad things had become there.
Oh, no doubt. All right. But since you were wrestling every night down on the Gulf Coast in those days, were you aware of how bad things were back in Knoxville, or were you just basically focused on your show and they got to do what they got to do up there? What was that like?
Well, you know, I had no idea what was going on there. And if I wasn't recording these weekly studcasts and doing the research on this subject and getting the information about these cards from my good friend Ed Harrison, I wouldn't know now exactly what was going on. So I would have never known any of this, except for I got a call during this time frame from Ole Anderson. And I do have a great little story about this call. My deal with Jim Barnett and Fred Ward, the Georgia promoters that bought me out of southeastern Knoxville, was that I was going to get $25,000 down, $500 a week, until they had paid me $150,000 total. I had not been paid anything except the down payment and none of the $500 a week payments since November of 1979. Now, I knew Barnett especially, and I know Ward was pretty well off too. I knew they were good for it. And since we were going to be doing great business in the Gulf Coast, and we were, I was kind of letting it ride each week, you know, because I knew when I asked for it, I was going to get it. So as I said a few minutes ago, I had no idea how they were doing in Tennessee until I got a call from Ole Anderson, July 1980. He was speaking on behalf of Jim Barnett, told me that right up front. Hey, Ron, I'm booking, but, you know, Jim wanted me to call you. And he said he told me business in Knoxville was not so good. That's what Dolly said, you know. Hey, Ron, business is bad here, right? But, but I didn't ask him why, you know. And he said Barnett had told him to call and ask me if he and Fred Ward could pay me the entire balance owed for the territory and the entire deal, pay me for all of it right now.
Okay, that had to be quite a surprise and a good chunk of money if you decided to take it. So why do you think they wanted to do that at all?
Well, Ole was pretty much a straight shooter, man. And I have to say that as a compliment to Ole. Not all boogers were. And he had, you know, he had said business was not good. He told me the truth. And I got the feeling that Barnett was not going to be staying there much longer. And probably he was already talking to potential buyers about a sale. So, you know, and if he paid me all the money he owed me, I would certainly have no problem with that. So in the next studcast, I think this might be a great subject for another hidden history lesson in the next studcast to talk about what Jim Barnett was doing, who he was talking to. I think fans will be very surprised at who buys this from Barnett and Fred Ward.
Okay, wait, you mean they could have been looking to sell out after less than a year? Wow. Okay, all right, I love these studcasts. You're throwing back that kayfabe curtain almost every week now, telling things never talked about before on wrestling podcasts that I'm aware of. Before our break, can you give us the card for the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory? And let's go to the second week of July, 1980.
Well, it was going to be the same card for all three major markets in the territory. We're talking about second week of July, 1980. It's five main event card out of seven matches. Historic. And to my knowledge, probably never been done before. And that evening, the card opened up with Roy Lee Welch against the Avenger. Then Charlie Cook was taking on the 6'10", 430-pound Plowboy Frazier, who was seconded by Floyd, both of them were wearing overalls. Then another of those very popular three-man matches was going to take place, with the winner getting a shot at the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion. The three contestants in this three-man match were Norvell Austin, Sweet Brown Sugar, and Ricky Gibson, three great junior heavyweights. The new United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Jerry Stubbs, was going to be defending against the former champion, Tony Charles. And then for the Southeastern Championship, Rob and I were defending against, we had a new team. It had been Randy Rose and Plowboy for 2 weeks. Now it's Randy Rose and the Big C has decided he's going to get in the ring himself and win the championship. Then the Southeastern title was on the line as well, champion Bob Armstrong, facing the former champion Mongolian Stomper, who was going to be managed by the Big C. Mm-hmm. And the last main event was a Canadian lumberjack match with wrestlers carrying belts, surrounding the ring, and every time somebody got out for whatever reason, they got whipped by belts until they got back in the ring. So they didn't stay out very long, I can tell you that, if they got out at all. Right. So this one was Joe LaDuke against Ron Bass, managed by the Big C.
All right, so that was the five main events in seven matches. One of those classic three-man matches, three championship matches, and a Canadian lumberjack match with Joe LaDuke against Ron Bass. All right, so we'll begin with the TV show and what Don Carson had in store for Jerry Stubbs. And let's do that right after the break. We'll be back when this Studcast continues. Hey, Studcast fans, it's David Summers. And if you live anywhere in the southeastern United States, you're invited to Charlotte, North Carolina's Hilton University Place on Saturday, August 3rd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Premier Signatures Desk to meet the stud for autographs and an opportunity to purchase his best-selling novel, Brutus, personally autographed to you. For a special price, his brother Robert, WCW's Colonel Rob Parker, and WWE's Tennessee Lee will also be there. Don't miss your chance to meet the Fuller Brothers, Charlotte, North Carolina, Hilton University Place, 8629 J.M. Keynes Drive, Charlotte, 28262. We'll see you there. Okay, Studcast fans, welcome back to another Studcast. It's David Summers here with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This one is called Historic, five main events on seven match card. All right, I've been looking forward to this TV show since the last personality profile where Jerry Stubbs went over Don Curtis, the Southeastern Commissioner's head, went over his head to change the card on several matches. Now, I noticed Don Curtis in this situation was not, I think he, as I recall, was not in town. So will Jerry Stubbs get straightened out on this TV show?
We're about to find out, my man. Yeah. And a lot more, actually, as this TV show just kept getting better and better. And since this was July, and I hadn't mentioned this, I don't believe, in the last one, it was the first one in July. We're in the second week in July, and guess what that is? It's rating period month. So this one is going to be extra special with another unusual personality profile.
All right, cool deal. All right, so how did it open up?
Well, it opened up with Charlie running down the TV lining and the studio fans getting off to a booing start because Big C and the Mongolian Stomper came right to the set with Charlie to join him right off the bat for the show. And fans were lucky in a way because Stomper wasn't wrestling. If he'd have been wrestling, they'd have probably stampeded the audience on the opening of this show. But it didn't happen because they were coming to the set. So they watched the video of a Southeastern Championship match from Montgomery, Alabama, the week before. And this video opened up with a crowd shot of almost 5,000 fans in that beautiful Civic Center. Wow.
Wow. It looked tremendous. Yeah.
And that kind of said it all about how hot the territory was. The match was just as hot, though. And the Big C got his Mongolian Stomper disqualified to keep him from losing the belt. From losing the match. He had already lost his belt, but this kept him from actually getting beat by Bob. So Charlie pointed out the upcoming championship match for the next week was going to be a no disqualification match because Big C got Stomper disqualified. They wasn't going to be able to win or get anywhere, get him disqualified on the next one. So Big C bragged about how most of the Stomper's victories had happened when the Stomper was allowed to do anything he wanted to do. So, I love these no disqualifications because it just opens the door for my maniac here to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, the wild man in a wild fest. All right. So set up the first match. Who was in the first TV match?
The first TV match was the Southeastern champion, Bob Armstrong. And he was going to be defending his belt on TV. It's a rating period. And guess who he's defending against, man? The 6'10", 430-pound Cowboy Frazier, managed by Floyd there, both of them in their overalls. First match on TV, Bob Armstrong against Cowboy Frazier.
Do you recall how tall was Bob Armstrong?
Bob was about 6'3", I'd say. Six,
wow.
6'3".
And what, maybe 250?
Yeah, 240, 250.
Okay.
Quite a bit shorter and less heavy than big old Plowboy, I can tell you that.
Yeah, almost half the weight. All right, that's a great way to open a TV show. A championship match with two of the territory stars against each other. So did the Big C and the Stomper, did they stay at the set with Charlie during the match?
Well, they were invited to, but the Stomper got so mad when Bob came to the ring. He had that belt on, and the fans were going crazy. They loved Bob anyway, and the Stomper couldn't stop himself. He just charged the ring like he was going to do something about this before it even started. And so Big C grabbed him and tried to hold him, but there's no way Big C could handle doing anything with the Stomper. And when Stomper got to the ring, he jumped up on the apron, and Bob met him at the ring ropes, and boy, they went at it. I mean, you know, match hadn't even been introduced yet. You got Stomper and Bob flailing each other on the apron of the ring, and just about the time Bob blasted Stomper off the apron, Plowboy attacked him from behind. So they rang the bell, and Frazier and Big C and Randy Rose came out. Ron Bass had to come out. They got hold of the Stomper, and they finally dragged him back to the dressing room. By that time, though, Big C had taken over. And meanwhile, I mean, not Big C, but Frazier, right? And Plowboy was quite a load to take care of, not only with his weight, but with his height, too. So Frazier was having his way with Bob, and he almost pinned him. In fact, he covered him three times. Twice he came off the ropes, and he splashed him for 400-plus pounds. You know, and I don't know how anybody else would have been able to kick out, but Bob managed to. And then Bob started fighting back, and boy, when he did, that studio went crazy. They got to chanting, "Go, Bob, go," and he did just that, and he tore into Plowboy. And he got broke down a couple of times on his karate on him even. And then he jumped on his back and he put his sleeper hold on him. And the studio crowd, they were going crazy. Plowboy dropped down on one knee, which I was surprised to see. You know, he's so big, had big old neck and a big head. And, you know, I was surprised to see him go down at all in any way. But and then for the first time, Floyd, his manager, who had never been in the ring since he came, he jumped up into the ring and he jumped on Bob's back. And so Bob released Plowboy. Plowboy kind of crawled away and out the other side of the ring. And then Bob made poor old Floyd pay, boy, because he put the sleeper on him instead of Plowboy. And the referee at the end of it, you know, he put him to sleep. Bob just turned him loose, let him fall on his face. And the referee raised his hand. He had disqualified him as soon as Floyd hit the ring. And so Bob did something very unusual. He was pretty upset. He left the ring and he didn't wake Floyd up. He just left the ring. Floyd laying face first in the ring. So a whole gang of heels led by Plowboy, obviously. He came back out of the dressing room, into the ring, and it was a Big C, and I think Randy Rose, and four or five heels that came out, and they finally managed to get Floyd woke up. And so the Big C didn't miss the opportunity to make Bob look bad, though. He charged over the set at the Charlie, screaming about how dangerous that sleeping hole was, and claiming, you know, poor old Floyd could have died. That's the way he put it. You know?
All right. That's a great way to begin a TV show. All right. So how about the next TV segment? What happened there?
Well, Rob and I were in the next, in the next segment. We had our tag belts and we went to the set with Charlie. We watched a video. This one was shot in Dothan. First one was shot in Montgomery. This video was shot in Dothan. And it was another massive crowd, over 5,000. And we got a win over Randy Rose and Plowboy Frazier from the night before this TV show. We wrestled on Fridays there. And then the next day, we're showing what happened to the Dothan fans. All the TV fans, most of them, had been to the matches. So this loss by Big C's team was the reason that Big C was willing to change things up to get Plowboy out of the tag team situation and to take his place. So, and he was quickly going to win two tie. He had just recently, the Mongolian Stomper was a Southeastern champion, and he had champions with Randy Rose. And now he had nobody as a champion. He had quickly gone from having two Southeastern titles to none. And he was desperate. And he was determined that he was going to be the guy that could get it done and get his hands on at least one of those belts in the next week.
Wow. All right. I have to ask, why did you record matches in all three major cities?
Well, that's a good question. Always felt like that fans in the major cities deserve to see a video at least every once in a while from their home city. And what I always thought was when they saw these huge crowds in these videos, and it made them want to become a part of it. And there was no better way for a fan to become a part of it than to be there live and see it live. So, you know, I always thought that exposing those shows to local fans, it was good for business. It created more business. Mm.
All right, so that makes sense. So how about the second TV match?
Well, the next opponents that were going to be in the ring, And we're going to be wrestling for our belts. Me and Rob, we talked, we watched what happened from Dothan. And then, you know, out came Randy Rose and Big C. Big C's going to be in the ring himself on this one. Great way to start it out. A show on TV, especially during rating period. And they had a couple of tough opponents. They didn't have any two guys that were easy to beat. They were going up against Charlie Cook and Roy Lee Welch.
All right, so the Big C, Don Carson, occasionally wrestled, not just managerial duties?
Yeah, well, and now especially he thought at this point, he was desperate. He wanted to get his belt, a tag belt or somebody's belt back for him. And he was willing to say, hey, I'll just do the job myself. I think that was his attitude. He thought he was going to get this done himself.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So because it was rating period for TV shows across the country, you were really loading up this TV, right? I mean, it sounds like it.
Oh, yeah. You better believe it, man. I mean, and just over, you know, it was just in our third year down there on the Gulf Coast, and we were pushing hard. I wanted to hit that 80 share like we had in Knoxville. And, you know, we got to the 80 share in Knoxville within the first 3 or 4 years. I was pushing to get there. And this match, this TV match was spectacular. The one with Charlie Cook and Roy Lee Welch against Big C and Randy Rose. And wow, the Big C and Randy Rose, they had to work hard, man, to get the win. Actually hard enough that the Big C had to cheat and he had to load his glove to get a win over Roy Lee.
All right. So you had been having some really fantastic personality profiles in the last month or so. After what happened with Jerry Stubbs in last week's profile, I've been kind of anxious awaiting this profile. So set it up for us. Who was in it this week?
Well, there were so many wrestlers in this one, Dave. For the first time ever, we had to do the profile from inside the ring. So after the second match and during the commercial break, we had a little 2-minute break where the TV crew, which was really great at moving things around in a short period of time, they put one of the big personality profile chairs over inside the ring. Then they put 5 steel chairs facing the profile chair. Then Charlie Platt entered the ring and also did 5 junior heavyweight wrestlers. Tony Charles was in there, Novell Austin, Ricky Gibson, Sweet Brown Sugar, and Jerry Stubbs. And Stubbs was the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, and he took the last of the 5 seats, and he had his belt with him. So when the profile began, Charlie introduced the Southeastern Wrestling Commissioner, Don Curtis, who was there. And boy, he got a great welcome from the studio audience. Fans really loved Curtis, and they had for good reason, right? So then Charlie left the ring. He didn't even stay in for the profile. Don Curtis took the personality profile seat, and he also took over the show, man. So he welcomed the 5 wrestlers. They were all sitting in front of him, and he described them as 5 of the best junior heavyweight wrestlers in the world. And he told them all, he said, you know, Southeastern Wrestling is honored to have every one of you. And then he said, you know, it was most unusual for any wrestling company to have this many great challengers for one championship belt, which is true, and that they were all competing for the title. And he said, in the process, you guys have been providing fans with some of the greatest wrestling matches I have ever seen, talking about himself. And he watched all these shows, so he knew exactly what he was talking about. And then he singled out Norvell Austin, Ricky Gibson, and Sweet Brown Sugar. And he told them that they were going to be involved in the very popular another one of these 3-man matches. And that Southeastern had created these matches and that they had proven to be an excellent way to select future opponents for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship challengers. So and that the 3 of them were going to be in the next 3-man match in the upcoming week, to choose the challenger for the United States Junior Heavyweight belt the week after that. So he excused Ricky Gibson, and then he told Norvell and Sweet Brown Sugar that they were going to be wrestling in the next TV match, immediately following the profile. And he excused them, and they left the ring. So that basically left him with just Tony Charles and Jerry Stubbs, and, you know, who was the current champion. And they were booked on the upcoming card to wrestle for the belt. Don apologized to Tony Charles for what Jerry Stubbs had done last week, removing Tony Charles from a title match. And he wished Tony good luck in his upcoming match for the belt, and he excused them. So that left only Jerry Stubbs and Don Curtis in the ring. And Curtis then started in on Jerry Stubbs, man. The first thing he said to him, he said, you know, Stubbs, he says, I'm very disappointed that you being the new champion had no idea how to act like one. <For sure. laughs> A great way to start it, I thought. And then the studio crowd, they burst into cheers. They loved it. You know, and as Stubbs turned his head and looked back at the crowd on the bleachers, and they were cheering, and then they all started booing as soon as they saw him looking back at him. So Stubbs had a lot of heat. And for having been there as a heel for a short period of time, he had a lot of heat. So Curtis continued, and he told Stubbs, he said, you basically have no right to change anything on any Southeastern card ever, like you did last week. And the crowd cheered again. And then he told him, he said that Tony Charles should have had the championship match last week, and he was definitely going to get it this week. And then he said, he got another expression of appreciation from the studio crowd. They were into everything he was saying to him. And then he got out of his chair, and he walked over, and he reached down, and he took the belt from Jerry Stubbs' lap. And he looked down at him, and he said, you're no longer the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion.
What?
He says, and if you want this belt back, he says, you're going to have to win it again.
Wow.
So this 30-year-old crowd exploded on that one. And so did Stubbs. Stubbs almost went too far. He jumped up, and when he did, Curtis never backed up, so he was basically face-to-face with him. And you could tell real quick as Stubbs was looking him in the eye, that was a very dangerous guy's eye to be looking into, mm-hmm. with Don Curtis, man. And a lot of guys had done that before, man. And you could tell that right away Stubbs recognized, oh, boy, he sat back down real quick. He never said anything. He was going to say something, but
wow.
Just looking at Curtis's face, he was like, oh, boy, no, I got to get out of here. So he says, and then Curtis, once he sits down, Curtis says to him, he says, unlike what I did with Tony Charles, I'm not going to wish you good luck. And he left the ring with Stubbs' belt to a thundering applause.
Wow, that was awesome, Stud. I never got to see Don Curtis in person, but this profile gives me a really good feeling about him. All right, so he must have been very well respected to kind of, yank Jerry Stubbs' chain and get his attention that way.
Yeah, I mean, he was certainly well respected, Dave. God, I can guarantee you that. I just got a quick little story. I got to throw this in here while we're on. This just came to mind, and I want to tell you why he was so respected. In my second year in the Florida territory, I was in the snake pit for my second year too, and some reporters with the sports section of the Tampa Tribune newspaper had written a bad write-up about wrestling, not being real. Wow. And Eddie Graham, God, he was the only guy I'm maybe more afraid of than Curtis. And Eddie Graham was a major stockholder in the company. So he got in touch with him down at the paper because Eddie was very, very good about the things he did for the community, and they respected him at the paper. And he invited him to send those sports writers down to the Sportatorium, which was the wrestling office. It was the TV studio, and it was where the snake pit was located. And he wanted to give a little exhibition of what professional wrestling was really all about to these sports writers that had written that story. So Don Curtis was one of the wrestlers that Eddie invited to be there when these guys came down. And there were several of us there because it was a normal day for us working out in the snake pit. This time, even Jack Briscoe was there. So there were two or three reporters came in, and they all got an opportunity to ask about certain things. And during the course of this little set-to here with these sports writers, one asked about the sleeper hold, saying that he believed it wasn't real. So Don Curtis was so good with the sleeper. That was how he won so many of his matches. And so Don Curtis got in the ring with him, and and he started to explain to him how it worked. And there was a photographer. They had sent a photographer along with these three reporters. And the photographer was standing right next to the ring apron. So Curtis just walks very politely around behind the reporter, and he's talking to basically him and the reporter at the same time, and they all got an opportunity to ask about things. So one asked about the sleeper hold, obviously, saying he believed it wasn't real. So Don Curtis got in the ring, and he explained how it worked. And so Curtis got behind the reporter, and he put his arms kind of loosely around the reporter's neck. And the reporter said jokingly, "Wow, I can't believe he had the guts to do this." He says, "I know this hold doesn't work," he says, "but I'm going to let you try." And while the three of us were standing there, we cracked up. Wow. So then Don started talking very softly to the photographer, mm-hmm. who's standing next to the ring at this point, and he's explaining the carotid artery and where it is in the human's neck and how it works and how if you cut off the blood supply to the brain, that it caused someone to pass out rather quickly, right? And about that time, he kind of gently clamped down on that reporter's neck. And the reporter went out almost instantly. His arms went limp and it was hanging there. And Curtis was holding his body up with a sleeper. And the photographer starts snapping pictures. And Curtis lays him down and flat on his back on the mat. And the photographer, like I said, he's snapping pictures like crazy. And you could tell he had a smile on his face, too. He was like, "Wow, Dad, he sees this." So Don then set this reporter up, and he slapped him on the back of the neck. And then he reached underneath his arms, and he raised him up and stood him on his feet, right? You know, got him back on his feet and held him there, you know. And then he was still kind of talking to the photographer. And the reporter, you know, by this point, he'd regained consciousness. And he stood there, and he was looking down at the photographer. And the first thing out of his mouth, he says to the photographer, he goes, mm-hmm. "See, I told you so. He couldn't put me to sleep." And everybody in the building started laughing. Eddie and all of the wrestlers, the photographers, even the other sports writers, because he had been asleep. He never even knew it. So then the photographer says, "Come here." He says, "You didn't go to sleep?" And the guy says, No, he didn't put me to sleep." He said, "What is this?" And he showed him the picture of him laying flat on his back.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, he said, "And you still say he didn't put you to sleep?"
Wow. That's a great story. I love these wrestling stories. They're so much fun. All right. So for fans that have never seen him, Google Don Curtis, wrestler. He certainly looks like a tremendous athlete in the photos that I've seen. But to do that, to somebody, I mean, to me, and then not even, they didn't even know it, was pretty wild. All right, how about the next TV match? Take us to that.
Well, Norville Austin and Sweet Brown Sugar, man. And they were going at it. They didn't like each other, man, big time. And they tore that studio up. They probably wrestled a 15, 20-minute match. I'm sure everybody at home were watching as well. They really enjoyed this. Wow, it was great. They both got disqualified, but it left everyone watching, man, waiting to see this upcoming three-man match when the two of them and three Ricky Gibson was going to be thrown in as a third man. It was coming up in the next week. They were eager to see it, I'm sure.
All right, so what about the last TV segment?
This one opened up with Joe LaDuca at the set with Charlie. And they watched a video. Again, this was the third video in this show. And this one came from Mobile. And it had been shot 4 days earlier. It was a no disqualification match where both guys were bloody, and they had been bloody in pretty much every match they had had, Bass and LaDuca. But they left the ring and they were counted out on the floor of the arena. And that was the reason that the next match they were going to be involved in was a Canadian lumberjack match. And that's where the ring was surrounded by wrestlers. Each guy had a belt, and when guys came out, you just started whipping them, man, until they went back in the ring. And Joe had explained the rules because it was his type of match, Canadian lumberjack. And you didn't have – that was the only type of match, lumberjack matches I've ever seen that had belts, that had this element to it. So, he put the emphasis on it about having a belt. And then he stood up and – you know how Joe was. You never knew what Joe was going to do. He pulled his leather belt out of his pants, and he told Charlie. He says, "This is what it's going to sound like next week." And he took the belt and he folded it over, and he raised it up over his head, and then he swung it across the desk in front of Charlie, and wow, you could hear that belt pop downtown Dothan, man. I mean, that's like, wow. So everybody in the building except Joe LaDuca screamed, even Charlie. And then the wrestler in the last match, Ron Bass, he screamed too, I'm sure. So it was his first Canadian lumberjack match. He'd never been in one of these type of matches. So he's watching this in the dressing room, and he sees LaDuca pull the belt off and slap it across that desk. And he came busting out of the dressing room on the far side of the ring. Big C and Randy Rose, Mongolian Stomper, they're all trying to hold him back from the set. And he's kind of pulling them with him, and he yells at LaDuca. He says, "Nobody's going to beat me like that." Big C and his men, they kind of diverted him to the ring because he was in the last match and he was halfway to the set. So they got him turned around, got him back to the ring. And boy, when he went in the ring, he didn't hesitate. He didn't wait on me introducing or anything else. He just attacked that poor guy that was standing across the ring from him. And Joe LaDuca, during this entire short match, just kept whipping the desk, man. Wow. Just popping that desk, and Bass kept whipping his opponent, man. And he ended up beating him with a horrifying Texas Stampede finish. Wow, I thought he killed the guy. And in fact, the guy had to be carried from the ring.
Okay, so that's just a great TV show, absolutely. I mean, from start to finish, there was something happening. So what happened in the arenas the following week?
Well, Roy Lee Welch beat the Avenger. Charlie Cook and Plowboy Frazier wrestled to a 20-minute time limit draw. Pretty good match, actually. Charlie Cook was a great wrestler, and Plowboy was a lot of guy to beat. Not easy to beat him. And the first of the five main events was the next match in this seven-man card. And it was a great three-man match. And the winner was going to be wrestling the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion the following week. And Norvell Austin won this match. And wow, Norvell was getting over at this point. Fans really liked him. And he got a thunder and a pause.
All right. So I guess that U.S. Junior Championship match was next. So who won that?
Well, it was the second of the five main events. Jerry Stubbs again pulled something from his wrestling boot, as he had done the first time, to beat Tony Charles to win the belt. Mm-hmm. And he beat him for a second time. And he was going to be, for the first time, as the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, facing Norvell Austin the following week. The third main event was Rob and I, and we successfully defended our Southeastern tag belts against Randy Rose and the Big C. And then the fourth main event, Bob Armstrong and Mongolian Stomper, were both counted out on the floor, fighting. not just close to the ring, but pretty much all over the building. And they're no disqualification Southeastern Championship match. Then the Canadian Lumberjack between Joe LeDuc and Ron Bess, that had to be stopped. I mean, that match went on for probably 20 minutes. But Bass kept getting thrown out by Joe LeDuc and getting blistered, man. And I mean, then as it happened quite a few times in these Lumberjack matches, especially these Canadian ones, the wrestlers on the floor got into it with hitting each other with belts. And it turned out to be a wild one. They had to stop the match. I mean, wow. It was just totally out of control.
All right, that's a wild night. I mean, really a wild night. So how about the attendances for this great card? You had to do great.
All three major cities were above 5,000, and that's basically what it was the week before, except this time they were all far enough above it to sell out. And the crowds had to be shut down. I don't know how many people got turned away in those three cities, but a lot of people couldn't get in the building.
All right, you couldn't do any better than that, in my opinion, because the buildings would not hold any more people than that. I'm sorry, but we're not going to have enough time for our learning tree question this week. This has been a ton of fun so far. And listen, hopefully we'll get back to that learning tree question next week. So this has been another tremendous studcast. No wonder you're breaking records each week now. So where are we going to ride next week? What do we expect next week, Stud?
Well, we're going to be back with the next Tennessee card in Knoxville. And then we're going to have a hidden history lesson next week. I think it'll be a very interesting one. We're going to be basically discussing the sale of Southeastern Knoxville. I sold it 9 months, 10 months later. They're looking to sell it again, man. Things are just not going well there. And we're going to be, and it's going to involve a different territory this next sale. It's not going to be to Georgia people. It's going to be to owners of an even bigger territory. And then in our Southeastern Gulf Coast territory, we're going to, it's on fire down there, man. And then we've got another phenomenal card. And another TV show. In fact, I think the next card is going to be 5 main events again as well. And so we're going to give the results of the cards and the attendances. And hopefully we'll have another learning tree question as well.
All right, folks, you know how to get up with our buddy Ron. On Facebook, it's simple. Find him at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. Twitter or X, you can find him at Ron Fuller Welch. Follow him there also. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com, tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. You can shop the stud store where you can get 43 super studcasts, 4 different 8x10 photos, the thrilling lion novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you, as a matter of fact, and t-shirts. They're still on sale for only $15.99, all with free shipping. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. Go to YouTube, put in Southeastern Rewind. It's the first thing that pops up. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment. 433 total videos are there. The last 136 studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, and 115 short rides with the stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars, 23 studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. That's YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It is the best deal in wrestling. And Ryan, before we go away, I got to say, I really enjoyed catching up with you. I think it was Saturday a week ago when you were at the event in Ozark, Alabama. Charlie Platt and I had the opportunity to come over and hang out a few minutes. That was a ton of fun, and it was a great opportunity to hang out with the stud a few minutes.
Well, I appreciate that, man, and it was great seeing Charlie, too. Great seeing you guys, and actually, man, I enjoyed Elvis, too.
That's my buddy Jerome Jackson.
Great job with the national anthem. Yes, sir. It's a great way to start that evening.
Yes, sir. All right, any final comments today, Ron?
Well, man, I'd just like to big thank you out there to everybody for your continued support. Please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.